Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. This is Renee, and I'm glad you joined us this morning. You know, we have a lot of interesting, very, very interesting characters in our history. And I want to say that one of the most interesting ones Good morning again, everybody. I don't know what happened, but I lost connection. Are you there, Shell?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. I can.
Okay, cool.
But that was weird. I heard somebody click on the phone. And there's nobody here that would get on the phone, and then all of a sudden I lost connection. So living out here in a mobile home park with all new kinds of lines and everything for our phone system, for our internet, everything, and Lake Worth still is not united in who does everything. You know, like
oh, wow.
way out in the acreage, you could get one AT&T did everything. You got a bundle,
right.
And you know. They do everything from your television to your phone to your cell phone to your internet, everything. Here in the acreage, I had apparently AT&T now has bought DirecTV because there's not enough lines to get the cable for cable television. So I think that might be one of our big problems out here because I will lose connectivity on the phone. The TV is still on, the internet was still on, but the phone was disconnected.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So today I really, really want to talk about Harry Houdini, and I'm having trouble with my bringing up the story. So let's talk about him briefly while I'm waiting for that to come up. It started as a little boy in, like, sideshows and stuff like that. And you remember when they used to have traveling minstrel shows and things like that that we all see in the movies. None of us are old enough to remember those, but we've certainly seen that kind of history on television in one form or another. And
right.
He and his little brother got started doing magic tricks, you know, in these shows. And then from magic, he went to learning how to escape. And do you know there were times in his life when he actually, like, dislocated his shoulders and stuff like that to be able to squeeze through spaces?
Wow. No, I mean,
I
thought that he was like a contortionist, that he was able to do that, but
yeah.
I didn't know. I mean, when you say dislocated, do you mean like the way that somebody who's double-jointed does or that he injured himself?
Well, many times he hurt himself. But yeah, that is what I mean. He could like they showed in the movie that they made with this new movie that came out on the History Channel. They showed his skeletal body in when he was locked in the chains and all that kind of stuff, hanging upside down in water or from the top of a building or something, and he would actually take his shoulders and like flip them out of their sockets so that they'd press down close to him so that he could squeeze through something and then pop them back
there
in.
There are people, one of the guys Stan Lee Superhumans that can do that. He's not a Houdini. I mean, he doesn't do magic tricks, but he's a contortionist, and he can move
mm-hmm.
his body in such unnatural ways that he can squish his whole body into a box, or he can get out of things that you or I couldn't because he is able to do that. He's able to spin his joints around in a way that most people can't.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what they showed him.
It actually makes you a little nauseous to watch them
yeah.
because you watch these
uh-huh.
people that can do that and you imagine yourself doing it, it makes you nauseous.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you get kind of like that sick feeling inside your stomach. And there
yeah, but,
there were
Yeah, but for them to do it, it doesn't affect them.
No, I know. Well, I remember in sixth grade, I had this girl in my class who was what she referred to was double-jointed.
Right, yeah.
And she could do, you know, like a back bend and walk her hands and her feet towards each other and lock her hands and her feet while she was in a back bend.
And
she was not a little girl. She did not look like one of the Cirque du Soleil Asian girls that look like they can do anything, you know, that are just so perfect and tiny and everything. This girl was a big girl.
Yeah.
And she could do anything like that. And she could touch her fingers, you know, pull her hand down and touch her fingers to her wrist or her forearm, frontwards and backwards. So she was like, I can remember watching her and thinking to myself, I mean, I was 12, and I can remember watching her and thinking to myself, how is she doing that? Is this like some kind of a trick? Of course, I know better. Well, I knew better very soon from then. But at that point in time, I had never seen anybody do anything like that. And I thought, is that some kind of a trick she's learned how to do? But no, it was actually the way her body was built. So it's very interesting. And I don't know whether that comes with practice or whether it's something that you can't avoid because your body wants to do it. What do you think?
Say that again?
I don't know whether it's something that you train your body to do or whether you don't really have any say in it. Your body just is that way.
Your body
really
just
double-jointed.
Yeah, being double-jointed is a physiological... I don't want to use the word deformity, anomaly. That's probably a better word.
Mm.
People that are double-jointed, it's actually a physical condition they're born with, and they're able to move their body differently. It's not something you can train for. You're either double-jointed or you're not. You can't stretch your body to the point. Now, then people can become more limber and agile and be able to do things. But when you're talking like this guy who's on Super, I can't remember his name, and he's like the co-host of the show, so shame on me, I'm not recalling his name, but he's the host of the show for Stan Lee called Superhumans, and the reason he did that is because he's a superhuman, because he can bend his body in ways that the general person could not because of the makeup of his skeleton. You know, but there are people that are very, very agile that train by stretching their ligaments, and they can pick their leg up, and you know they can, like people that are in martial arts or in yoga, have the ability to stretch their bodies in incredible ways. But when you're talking true double jointedness, when somebody can actually pop their shoulder out or stuff like that, that you're born with.
Well, it's amazing and amusing all at the same time. I got a big kick out of seeing that part of things because I should see if we can find the original movie with Tony Curtis in it and see if it's anywhere because I don't remember learning all this stuff, but it could be just because I was not very old and not interested enough. I don't know, but we'll have to see if we can. Spike's my movie aficionado. I'll have him research and see if he can find it when that movie was made. And that had to be made in the 50s.
Yeah, 1953. They even talked about it on the quiz I took because one of the facts that they actually elaborate on in that movie isn't true. You know, it was one of the things, one of the rumors, one of the legends about Houdini that has survived for decades and decades isn't even true about how he died. So how did this movie show that he died, incidentally? Did they go there? Because I didn't see the end of the movie.
Yeah, I didn't. I fell asleep as well. But let me go through this, and this is... kind of a interesting points that they put together about the movie and about Harry Houdini. And it's on the Mother Nature Network, and it's 15 fascinating facts about Houdini. The new History Channel movie exposes the master magician's secrets, and we reveal a few more. Straitjackets, jail cells, coffins, and all sorts of chains locks and shackles could not confine Harry Houdini. A master illusionist whose caring stunts remain legend 8 decades after his death. Wow, see, so it's been 80 years since he died. Houdini was the first superstar of magic. But how do we really know, but how much do we really know about him? The new History Channel movie, Houdini, aired over 2 nights, September 1st and 2nd, with Adrian Brody in the title role, explores his life and his psyche, and reveals how he accomplished some of his greatest tricks. We see Houdini hiding a key inside a false finger and making the long, silent Kremlin-Kirillin ring for the Tsar Nicholas and his family by having an associate fire a rifle at the bell on cue. He was the sidekick in the movie, too, the young man who made everything. Houdini would think of it, and this kid would pull it all together. He was kind of amazing, too. It's too bad they don't talk a little bit more about him, because a lot of times Houdini had the vision and this kid would make it happen. But even more startling is the revelation that he worked undercover for many years, spying on royalty and political leaders of Europe for the American and British governments. The book, The Secret Life of Houdini, The Making of America's First Superhero, by William Kalush and Larry Sloman, goes deeper into Houdini's espionage adventures and divulges more about how he did it, secrets about his magic. The book paints a comprehensive picture of the magician's colorful life, some of the highlights. Number one, Houdini employed several methods of escape from handcuffs, leg irons, and jail cells. He'd hide a key or a lockpick under his foot or in his bushy hair with adhesive, in a hollowed-out compartment of a shoe, or rely on an accomplice who would palm the key in his hand to be retrieved by Houdini when they shook hands. If he could inspect a jail cell in advance, Houdini might plant his escape tool in a bar of soap or under a bench. Houdini similarly, well, I can never say that word, similarly, I don't know, I just can't say it, most of the time smuggled keys and picks into the boxes, milk cans, water tanks, and other containers that confined him in his act, manipulating them with his teeth or specially designed extension rods. In one of the scenes, he swallows it and regurgitates the pin. Did you see that part of it?
No.
That was kind of gross. Sometimes he would have the opportunity to use rigged handcuffs. The manacles would lock securely when held upright, but snap open when they were turned upside down.
Wow.
Houdini's access to heads of state and power players on his frequent trips to Europe, his fluency in German, and special abilities like subterfuge and sleight of hand made him an ideal candidate for espionage. Recruited by the British Secret Service, he passed along vital information he learned while performing for the Kaiser Wilhelm and the Tsar Nicholas of Russia. Houdini took his stage name from magician Robert Houdin, whose autobiography inspired him. Born in Hungary in 1874 as Eric Weitz, later changed at Ellis Island to Enric Weiss when his family immigrated to America. He performed as Eric the Great early in his career. Houdini was quite an athlete. He ran track, excelled at gymnastics, was an amateur boxer, all of which gave him the endurance, the stamina, and the strength needed to perform the difficult stunts that he did. An early aficionado of aviation, Houdini learned to pilot his own Voisin biplane and was the third person to fly across Australia in 1910. In December of 1914, Houdini was summoned to a private meeting at the White House with President Woodrow Wilson, who told him, "I envy your ability of escaping out of tight places. Sometimes I wish I were able to do the same." But Wilson couldn't evade the conflict raging in Europe. In April 1917, America declared war on Germany and joined World War I. During World War I, Houdini entertained troops and held classes for soldiers, demonstrating how to escape from ropes, handcuffs, and shipwrecks. Intrigued by spiritualism, Houdini included clairvoyant elements in his act and became fascinated by the idea of communicating with the dead after his beloved mother died. But his interest turned into indignation at mediums preying on the public, and he made it his mission to discredit them, including Lady Jean Doyle, wife of his friend and Sherlock Holmes creator, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. In an article Houdini wrote, "In the 25 years of my investigation and the hundreds of seances which I have attended, I have never seen or heard anything that could convince me that there is a possibility of communications with the loved ones who have gone beyond." Nevertheless, his wife, Bess, held on to the possibility. She continued to attend seances after his death, hoping to contact him. Houdini made several movies that showed off his escape skills, including Terror Island, The Man from Beyond, Haldane, The Secret Service, The Mastery Mystery, in which he played an undercover agent for the Justice Department. He has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame dedicated posthumously. Narrowly escaping death many times in his act, Houdini died in Detroit on Halloween, October 31st, 1926, from a peritonitis due to a ruptured, infected appendix. The week before, he'd been punched in the stomach by a college student challenging the magician's much-boasted about abdominal strength. The incident may have contributed to and aggravated his condition. Houdini was the longest-serving president of the Society of American Magicians from 1917 to 1926. Every year on the anniversary of his death, the organization holds a broken wand ceremony at his grave at Machpelah Cemetery in Queens, New York. A commemorative postage stamp depicting Houdini was issued in 2002, and the price of that stamp was 34 cents. So I found, of all the articles I looked at, I found this one to be, first of all, to the point, pretty quick, and interesting. What amuses me, though, or I don't know, amuse isn't the right word, interest me, is, again, the public is fooled. I mean, in so many different ways, right? In so many different ways. But the ultimate trickery is the fact that somebody that even people in power respect as a, well, as an entertainer, right? I mean, that's what he was doing. He was entertaining people, awing them, shocking them, getting them to believe in his trickery, was also being... he was a vehicle for trickery from our government, again.
Right, right.
Back in a day when I don't think, I mean, today wouldn't surprise anybody to find out that Robin Williams was working for the FBI. That wouldn't have surprised any of us, would it?
No, not at all.
But back in that day, I don't know. But it shows you how long our government, our leaders have messed with us, fooled us, tricked us. Although Houdini's job was not directed at the United States of America, really. It was for the United States of America, and for that reason we should be respectful of the fact that he was able to help us before some of the worst wars we've ever lived through took place, and maybe he was valuable to that. I didn't find anything that addressed whether or not his, you know, his secrecy and his doing all the things that he did like a spy helped us. I mean, the one comment about Woodrow Wilson but it doesn't say, thanks to Houdini, we knew this was going to happen before it happened. And did you see anything like that in anything you looked at?
No. In fact, I didn't see any elaboration on that at all. I'm wondering if it's elaborated on more in the book.
I don't know. I should make Big Spike read it. He loves to read stuff like that. I don't have the patience anymore. I should get the book for him and have him read it.
In the article you read, it mentioned the name Eric Weiss, and that was Harry Houdini's name when he came over. That area of the article sounded like it was talking about his mentor, but that was actually his name. Harry Houdini wasn't born Harry Houdini. His birth
right,
name was Eric Weiss.
Right, he was born Eric Weiss.
The way the sentences were put in that article, I knew that was, but it didn't read like that to me. So just in case any of the other listeners misunderstood that part, Eric Weiss was Harry Houdini's birth name, not the name of mentor who came over. He was the one who was renamed here his actual birth name was Eric Weiss, but he took the name Harry Houdini, which was like a fictitious name or a stage name, so to speak.
Well, let me read that. That's number five. Houdini took his stage name from magician Robert Houdin, whose autobiography inspired him. Born in Hungary, Harry was born in Hungary in 1874 as Eric Weitz, later changed at Ellis Island to Eric Weiss when his family immigrated to America. He performed the great early in his career. That's what that paragraph said. So
okay,
it isn't
good.
Real clear, but I understood what
it said.
What it
he,
meant.
And you didn't know which he they were talking about. They should have used the name there, because I thought you were still talking about Robert Houdin when they said he came. You know what I'm saying?
No.
I see
what you're saying. Yeah. No, Houdini took his stage name from magician Robert Houdin, whose autobiography inspired him. But you're right, then it jumps to born in Hungary. So, yeah, I can see where you would think that.
Because he actually had a passport.
You're right.
Houdini actually had a passport that said that he was born in Wisconsin, and I don't know how he got that. So they said a lot of people thought that Houdini was American-born, when actually he was born in Budapest, Hungary, which is what you just confirmed, and in 1974, March 29th, 1974. A lot of people thought that his father was this wealthy merchant. 1874.
Yeah. 1874.
And
that would make him in his 40s right now, I think.
And his name was Mayor Samuel Weiss.
Right. Well, it seems like I'm trying to remember in the movie, don't they address why they changed his, didn't somebody step in and change his birth certificate? Oh, I know, so he could go to Russia. I think that's why they did that.
Oh, okay.
That I think the British guy that came to him from the Secret Service, he changed his birth certificate so that Harry could go, you know, travel abroad and stuff like that, and not have to go through all the visas and all that stuff. I mean, they weren't called that then, and most people couldn't return once they had left a country like Russia. So I thought that's why they did it. And those are just assumptions on my part. But I remember that part in the movie of him saying, I can't go like that. I would love to, but I can't. And he hands him the birth certificate that says, you know, that he was born in the United States.
Ah.
So, yeah. But a very, very interesting character and a very, very interesting life. And I love the way in the second half of the movie when he starts trying to reach his mom and he, you know, he debunks all, even Lady Doyle and all that kind of stuff, people who were very high standing and very, nobody ever questioned their integrity just because of their, you know, their seat in the world, which We're getting away from a little bit. Now we've gone too far the other way. Now we don't respect anybody. But there was a time if you held an office, a seat, a family name gave you respect and didn't matter what kind of a creep you were. You could get anything you wanted if the name Smith meant you were upper echelons, you were treated as such. And now, of course, we've gone the other way. Speaking of old interesting stories, though, while I was researching this week and looking at other stories about Houdini, you know that they actually found an old, like, shawl kind of a wrapping from one of the last victims of Jack the Ripper. And one of the policemen, way back in the day, took it from the scene, took it home, gave it to, I guess it was his wife or his girlfriend or something, and she realized what it was and couldn't, you know, gave her the creeps, so she put it away in a trunk. And they found it recently. And with today's innovations, they were able to do a DNA on the on this shawl and found Jack the Ripper's blood and named him. Did you see that on the news or in anything that you've looked at in the computer?
No, that's astonishing because they had, all along they've had two or three different suspects, all that fit the mental makeup, the surgical skills of Jack the Ripper. But there were so many, and then at one point they thought that it was maybe a team. It was two different guys, you know, inspiring each other. But I had seen one movie where they leaned towards one person and another movie where they leaned towards these other two guys. So it'd be interesting to see who they finally said it was after all this time.
Well, you know, I made notes on it and figured we'd talk about it next week. But I just remembered it and I thought to myself, I thought that was very interesting. And, of course, that may happen a lot now, you know, Shell. Because
you got to keep in mind, that, you know, you watch these shows like Law and Order and Rizzoli and Isles, and they show how evidence is collected, NCIS and all these. I mean, there's so many crime investigation shows out there, and they show how when they go into a crime scene, everything is locked down and everything is collected with rubber gloves on and put in bags and labeled. But you have to understand that that's only, even in the United States, that's only been protocol for maybe 15 to 20 years at best, and in some places maybe only 10 years. Because I watched this this show called Cold Case Justice, or Cold Justice, and they go back into cases that are 16 years old, 20 years old, things like this, murders. They're all murders that were never solved, but where they believe the murderer is still, you know, up and around. So they go with near cold cases, you know, something that's not like 50 years old. And that's one of the things they talk about there is that the collection of, they didn't use the word pitiful. I'm using the word there. But the collection of evidence was pitiful because stuff would get trampled on by the police. The police would show up and just trample all over evidence and move things. And like this guy taking the shawl home is a perfect example. Before there were protocols like this, evidence was decimated a lot of times, and that's why it was so hard to solve crimes because the crime scenes were never preserved properly. This is something that's very, very new that police departments do, but in the past, crime scenes would get trampled all over, and it was very hard to recreate what had actually happened.
Well, and I mean, I can understand that. I'm sure you can, too, I mean, because we just didn't know what we know now.
Yep. Well, DNA didn't exist. Nobody knew that that type of preservation would ever be beneficial. I mean, the idea of DNA wasn't even a thought in anybody's head, you know. And then once DNA became a viable tool, which again was only very recently, still didn't understand the impact of preserving the crime scene at that point. You know, so it's interesting how things that we take for granted now and they're on all of our shows really have only been status quo or procedure just maybe in the last decade or two.
Right, right. Well, and I think that at the end of the day, we have to take into account that that even is changing almost minute by minute. The when we talk about how we don't quite understand sometimes how the government spends all the money that is accrued through taxes and through just every way they can collect money from all of us. We don't give enough recognition to some of those things because it only matters to you, Shell, when it matters to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you, God forbid, had somebody that you lost due to a some kind of act of violence, a crime of some kind, and you had to prove, somebody had to help you prove who the assailant was, then this part of our lives would become very important to you. That's how we work, you know. If it doesn't enter into what's going on in your life, you don't pay a lot of attention to it. Not because maybe you don't have an interest in it or you don't want to, just because there doesn't seem to be the time to check into it. Case in point is this adoption thing that's going on with Carrie. My God, my Facebook is every 15 minutes I've got 15 messages from people all over the world who have had something happen with an adoption agency or tell a story about giving their child up for adoption and being under the influence of Vicodin or some mood-altering pharmaceuticals so that they could deal with what they were doing, and people took their signature. And I mean, all these things are coming like out of the woodwork. Nobody talked about them so much before because nobody had eyed in on this part of our world, and it's the same with this stuff. I think that the other thing that this is going to open up, I think, for a lot of people, seances and belief that you can hear from the other side. I mean, you and I have met many people who believe they have a connection, and you and I have spent time with them, and it's not about whether or not we believe in it. It's how realistic it seems when you're with that person and what that person can tell you, especially if it pertains to you on a personal basis. So it's the same with the DNA. A lot of people don't think twice about the DNA unless something happens and they need those testings from the DNA. But this just blew me away because how many years ago was Jack the Ripper? Wasn't that the 1800s too? I forget the dates it told me.
Yeah, that was the 1800s. I don't remember the actual years, if it was late 1700s, early 1800s, but yeah, it was in the 1800s time frame. It was a couple hundred years ago. I don't remember the actual years involved.
Yeah, but pretty sure the 1800s. And here we are in the 2000s. So, I mean, that's a long time, which also teaches us something else. It also teaches us about the integrity of DNA. I mean, how awesome is that? I mean, think about it.
They can get DNA out of dinosaur bones. DNA is, if there's any bone marrow left. But, I mean, they're even showing they're getting DNA out of skeletal remains from people that were on the Earth thousands of years ago, as long as there's still some sort of bone marrow left, and they can get DNA from them. Did you know that?
Yes. I, matter of fact, I'd forgotten about it until you brought it up. But yes, I just watched something the other day on the History Channel. Spike's always watching that channel. Not me. I'm not that much in search of that kind of knowledge, but I do find it interesting. And
that kind of stuff too. But like they said that they've proven now that one out of every, I don't remember the statistic, but all I remember is the statistic surprised me. I think it was something like one out of every 200 people on Earth is a direct descendant from Genghis Khan. And they proved that through DNA. Isn't that an interesting thing? Because they were actually able to do DNA on his skeleton.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's amazing. I mean, I really think that's amazing. You know, years and years ago, I was, I think 12, maybe 13, and I met this woman. I babysat for her. No, I was older than that. I was 17, and I babysat for her, and she was a scientist at Cornell University, and she had three children, all very precocious, because she was like, I never met anybody like her in my life. Everything was about these rats that she worked with. I remember hearing an argument between her and her husband, and he accused her of loving the rats more than she loved her children. I mean, that's how intense she was about the experimentation she was doing with rats at Cornell University. Mm. And that's what they were researching, is DNA, and being able to, you know, separate rats, intermingle rats, be able to find out what rat came from this rat and that rat, you know, and I was like, it was way over my head, you understand? Way
over
my head.
Yeah, like genetics. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but now I think about it and I realize that thanks to somebody like Jean, she was a big part of us being able to trace people with DNA and understand, if you'll excuse the pun, the relativity of knowing about DNA. So, and that was in the, that was probably 1965, 1966,
right.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's how long they've been working on that kind of stuff. And of course, Cornell is a, you know, is an Ivy League college, but they have a very, very large agricultural and I mean, they have lots of schools at that university, and that was one of them. So it's been a long time in the making, but it certainly speaks volumes for some of the things that we've been able to do and some of the things that we get results from now from all those years of people working on it. So,
you know, I did want to go back on something else because this was a big point in the movie. One of the other facts, a couple other facts that came up on the quiz I took about Houdini, in 1926, he testified in front of Congress to support a bill banning fortune-telling because it became like an obsession with him. He was, and unfortunately, he came across the charlatans, and the charlatans were the soothsayers, the fortune-tellers, that were using all the props. You know, they would have bells hanging from the ceiling, or they'd have a string tied to their foot underneath the table, and they would make the table jump around and stuff like this. And unfortunately, these were the people he went to. You know, a true medium doesn't get into, just to kind of touch on that a little bit, because I've met true mediums. A very dear friend of mine, when I lived in New York, was a true medium, and her life was a mess. She could foretell things for other people, and yet she could never see it coming in her own life. And a lot of mediums, that's what it's like, because they're directed outward. They're not internal. So they don't even see half the time what's going to happen in their own life. You know, people always say, oh, you're a great psychic. But people that are sensitive like that generally perceive the world around them, not their internal world. So a lot of times their lives can be a total mess, and yet they can see with perfect clarity in the other people's lives. And but a friend of mine named Rita, She was an older woman. She was about 25 years older than me. I had met her when I was, in my teens, and she was astonishing. She could bump into somebody at a store, and all of a sudden she'd get a vision, and she would say something to them, and she would give them her card, and sure enough, they'd call her. Like, first they would think she's a nut, and then they'd call her 2 weeks later, and they'd say, oh, my God, that thing that you said was going to happen actually happened. And then so she had all these people that were astonished by her, but she would get flash visions if you touched her or something like that. It was and I used to see it happen all the time, but she could never perceive all these terrible things that happened to her in her own life, and she had a very tragic life, and I had known people like this. I had a couple other friends that were true mediums, and they all hated seances. They said that seances were dangerous to do, and they said that most seances, you don't have all the drama, and you like what they put in movies and stuff, that the, seances, if they're not done properly, can be dangerous, or if they're not done properly, are completely ineffective. So you can go from one extreme to the other. But most responsible mediums think seances are nonsense, that they should never be done for a variety of reasons. And most mediums are just sensitive. They can pick up on what's happening, and they can communicate with souls that have crossed over that haven't moved on yet, because sometimes souls become earthbound because of unfinished business and things like that. So it's very interesting. And there's some credible mediums out there today, like Cindy Dale and the woman who's on Montel Williams all the time. I forgot her name. I can't remember her full name. And Amy Allen, so there's some out there that are astonishing, and they do a lot with psychometry by touching things, but the whole seance thing is very theatrical, and unfortunately that's why Houdini, I don't think, ever met anybody real, because he was going to the show people, and I think 90% of the show people were all charlatans. That's what gave fortune telling a bad name to begin with, because so many people turned it into a circus sideshow, and that's where a lot of the mediumship got a bad name, because of all the charlatans that then took that real arena and turned it into something that was a sideshow. And unfortunately, that's all that Houdini came in contact with.
Well, I think that was the whole idea of finally seeing the guy who wrote Sherlock Holmes, him and his wife, and they were held in such high regard. But that's what I'm saying. Back in the day, your name meant everything. A lot of times you didn't have to have any gifts whatsoever in any arena. If you did and you had the right name, everybody believed you. And
right,
I think
right.
that's what he thought he was doing.
Right.
I think he thought he was going. I got to tell you, we're talking about all the gifts from people. We're talking about Harry Houdini. And this morning on that, I have the television on while I'm doing the show, and they have contortionists and record breakers on the Today Show this morning. And there is a young woman who is shooting a bow and arrow, standing on two pedestals on her hands, and she's shooting the bow and arrow with her feet and legs. At a
target. Geez. Oh, my God.
And she, a few minutes ago, turned herself around and had her knee turned around her shoulder and bent like the other way. I never saw anything. I mean, I've been to Cirque du Soleil, which I have tremendous respect for. It's an amazing show. But these people are, they're showmen, but that's some of their gifts is the fact that they are, we have a girl sitting on here right now who just took an apple and put it in the crooks of her arm and smashed it with the crooks, making a muscle with her bicep.
Wow.
And smashed the apple with her arm. And she's, she's beautiful. She's not muscle bound or anything like that. She's just really good at what she does. It just
amuses me.
Show is on a day when we're talking about Harry Houdini. I just thought
that was
kind of
funny. That's happened to me before, when we've done something on the show, and then it come up and something else, like within the hour that day. And I think it's funny, you know, when you talk about, you know, your mind's on something and then you seem to just, that's you keep getting confronted by the same thing throughout the day.
Well, and tomorrow we're going to do a tribute to 911. And it's, of course, a sad day. But I have some things that I'm going to read and talk about that. So if there's something that means something special to you, Shell, see if you can put it together to talk about it tomorrow, referring to September 11th.
Okay.
The other thing I wanted to bring up is that I connected finally with Abraham Frank. He's the gentleman that Izzy Kalman sent to me. And his he goes all over and talks to schools and gets kids, elementary school, middle school, kids to have moments of silence. And then he asks them to write what they thought about while they were being still and quiet. And he said the letters that he gets them from all over the world because he's done this in a lot of different places. And he says he often has to get somebody to, you know, read them to him, letters from Haiti and places like that. And I told him about what we talked about yesterday, the survey that the government wants to do to find out where the hot spots are in a school and everything. And he says, oh, that's great. I said, that's what Shelley and I thought, that was like one of the simplest first steps to take, but everybody seems to jump over the first steps, and you can't really do anything about it. And he says, how do you feel about what Izzy teaches? And I said, we work once a week out of Izzy's workbook. And he said, you do? And I said, yeah. I said, we find Izzy's workbook to be not just great for school-age children, but for us.
Right.
It's about being socially graceful. You know, it's about learning how to deal with people that don't like you or that you don't like and still not put yourself in a bad place. And he said, I never heard it summed up like that. And I said, well, that's the way we look at it. We look at it as teaching our kids how to be socially adjusted. The only time that you should give credence to something that said to you is if you believe it yourself. And of course, those kind of things are always more hurtful. It's like the girls and I and Larry all talked the other night, and we talked about friendship. Shelley and I have been friends with a group of women for a very long time. And for many years, when we all worked together at the Institute, every Friday night was our evening to go have dinner together, laugh about each other's mistakes during the week, kid a little bit about in-house guests, maybe talk about famous people that had been at the Institute that week, whatever. But we really bonded. And there were other people through the years that tried to join us. And they seldom fit in. And one of the ladies said the other night, why do you think that is? And I said, because the people at this table right now and a few others that are missing understand loyalty. And it's always been about the loyalty that we feel for each other. And that is another social grace, if you will, learning how to make friends and be loyal to those friends. Doesn't mean you don't get mad at them. Doesn't mean that you don't get upset by something they say. It's the fact that you can turn around and say, you know, why did you say that to me? That really hurt my feelings. Or, you know, what were you thinking? And we talked about that. And one of the women, who's the oldest of all of us, she is 79 years old and still works 20 hours a week. She said, what is it about that? She says, what is it that makes some people bond forever and some people just not? And I said, I believe in my heart that it has to do with who you feel is loyal to you and you are loyal to them, because loyalty is incredibly important, and that's the way family is supposed to be. I watched a video this week of a water buffalo being attacked by lions.
Oh, boy.
And the lions singled out the calf in a very, very small gathering of water buffalo. I think there was like 5 water buffalo and a calf. And the lions were crouched, and there were young people filming it. And this will give you chills, Shell. They creeped up on them, went after the calf, got the calf into the river that they were walking beside. All the other buffalo ran away. And the lions went in the water, and one lion, holding very still, was holding the calf by the neck. And several seconds went by watching this, and the other lions just sitting there anticipating the fact that they were going to have lunch. And an alligator, a crocodile, I'm not sure which, came up and tried to take the calf away from the lions. So that is going on, with the alligator trying to tug the calf away from them because he wanted it for his lunch, I'm sure. And the lions fighting back with the alligator. And finally the alligator goes back underwater, and you see them getting ready to pull the calf out of the water. The calf is not moving, so you're not sure whether the calf is still with us or not. Then all of a sudden you look, and here's like 100 water buffalo. And the leader comes stomping up to the lions, puts one of his horns down and just throws a lion out of the way. And the rest of them are all right there. The calf gets away. The remaining really, really leaders of this gang or this family of water buffalo takes the remaining lions until they've either ended up gored by one of their horns or just run away.
Oh, my God, wow.
I sat here staring at the screen, and I thought to myself, now, that was hard to watch. I'm not one of those people who likes those animal things where everybody kills everybody.
I don't like them either. But I do like the escapes.
Well, and Shell, 5 water buffalo went home and got the rest of the family.
Yep.
And they came back. And, you know, I mean, like, oh, yeah, you think you're going to take our baby? That's the way we're supposed to be. That's the way we're supposed to be. My comment under the video was, now that's what I call family. Because for me, spoke volumes. And the calf ran away. So the calf ended up, I'm sure, he or she had bites on its neck because you could see that it was like held perfectly still by the lion.
Wow. But the water buffalo stay submerged for a little bit, so it probably just, you know, played dead waiting for help to come. That's fascinating.
Well, I thought it was one of the best. I didn't like that, I was afraid this is going to be one of those gory, I'm going to yell at whoever sent it to me. But it wasn't. It was one of survival and one of unity. Unity is a big deal for me, and loyalty. And it's about everything. You know, if you're going to, be a part of a family, whether it's relatives or non-relatives, but a family, family means the gathering of people, all different ages, sizes, everything, and they stick together.
So is Abraham Frank going to be on the show?
Yes, he's going to be on the show Friday morning. And I love him already. He's very much like Izzy. He talks very matter-of-factly. And he said to me, he says, I just feel like we have to, you know, take a breath. And I said, I couldn't agree with you more. And he said, and I also feel like, he said, we both used the word reflection.
Right.
I shared with him about doing Silent Day at the Institute. And I said, and of course, as a staff member, I couldn't have a Silent Day. But on Wednesdays, we would fast with green drink. And I learned to take an hour out of the day, close my office door, and not talk to anybody. And on a day when you're fasting, that's incredibly, re-energizing.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it is. And I said, I know, because you always feel like you have to explain yourself. And sometimes if you can just shut up, you don't need to explain yourself.
Right.
And we don't know that. I said, so I think this is great. And I also have had grandchildren say to me, I can't think in my class, Grandma, because it's too noisy. He said, one of your grandchildren said that to you? And I said, yeah. I said, you'll have to meet him someday. He's not your run-of-the-mill kid. I said, but yes, many times. It's noisy in here. I can't even think. And I love him. You will love him as well. He travels all over and teaches people about the moment of silence. And he's sending me some stuff today, emailing me some stuff, so it'll be on the Heart to Heart page. And for those of you who don't know, there is now a Heart to Heart Facebook page. Please follow it and join us on it. You'll see things about the show and some of the upcoming guests and things like that. It's coming together. Thank you, Daniel Sohn, because he is responsible for that. Yours truly is not technical enough. You're lucky I can work the computer and the phone at the same time. So, and as you know, that's not always true. But, so tomorrow we will remember and give a little tribute to 911 and all the tragedy that struck us. The United States of America on that day, and then Friday, Abraham will join us, Abraham Frank, and talk to us about his moment of silence. I look forward to that. So, but for today, everybody go out and have a great day. One last thing, today is my husband of, 46 or 47 years, now I've lost count, is 71 today. So happy birthday.
Wow, happy birthday.
And he is cancer clean, and so we have a lot of reasons to celebrate. So everybody go out and have a great day. God bless, and we'll be back tomorrow. Thanks, Shel.
Wonderful. Have a wonderful day, everyone. Have a great day, Rainey. Thanks, and we'll talk to you in the morning.
Okay. Bye-bye.